we need to constantly be evolving and iterating on the strategy in order to respond to, for example, social justice issues or issues in the world that companies more and more are kind of stepping into and commenting on and leading on or taking a stand on. You know, this is evolving.
Welcome to Be More, a podcast by Peakon. This is where everyone at an organization can hear different and meaningful perspectives on how we can all thrive in this ever-changing and constantly evolving world of work. I'm your host, Patrick Kornoyer. Jennifer Brown is joining me today, and I cannot wait to have this conversation. In one word, she is amazing. Her caring, honest, and direct approach to the reality of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the world today, it's inspiring. But what I'm most inspired about with Jennifer is her vulnerability to share her individual story in such an authentic way, whether it's through her weekly podcast, which is titled The Will to Change, sharing her thoughts via Harvard Business Review or the New York Times, or in her most recent book titled How to Be an Inclusive Leader. Jennifer is transparent and she's incredibly engaging, which you are all about to experience. Jennifer, thank you for joining the conversation today.
Thank you, Patrick. I'm so excited to have this conversation. I love the optimism of your last area we're going to explore. It's good. It's important. It keeps us going. And there's so much actually to, I think, look forward to and to shape together.
Perfect. I agree. I think the times right now are the perfect opportunity for us to see what we can accomplish, to break down barriers and to build the future that we want in a lot of ways. So before we jump to the future, let's talk a bit about the past and about your journey. So you've had a very interesting journey. You worked in corporate America. You now run an extremely successful consulting business. So tell me about your journey and how you found the passion and internal inspiration to do the work that you're doing right now.
Thank you for asking that. It was, most of us in our field have an inside joke that none of us set out to be this. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. And, you know, until recently, there weren't a lot of, and there still aren't a lot of, you know, academic degrees, and sort of the body of work is evolving and I think developing and maturing. So I anticipate it will be a more robust field, quote unquote, but it's many of us got here through really winding and unlikely paths. Mine is no exception. I was in nonprofits in my early days. I always knew I wanted to make a difference and work from a place of purpose and have an impact. So I was a nonprofit advocate, community organizer. In fact, I met my partner, Michelle. We were community organizers at two social justice organizations in our 20s. Those were wonderful days. But I was also a singer. So I had cover bands and I was singing with the Boston Symphony Orchestra chorus. And I'm a classically trained musician since the age of 5. And so I decided I got to go to New York and see if I can make it. So I came to New York. I got my master's degree at Manhattan School of Music in operatic vocal performance. And I was sort of ready to go to be that triple threat Broadway performer, fully on the path. And unfortunately, my voice just refused to cooperate. And I ended up injuring myself several times and having to get vocal surgery and go through periods of total silence while the voice heals and then sort of nurturing it and coaxing it back. But, you know, after a couple times of this, it's really not really tenable to use your instrument to make a living with 8 shows a week at, you know, weeks and months at a time. It's a hard life anyway. So I had to reinvent, and I was so happy to discover ex-performers who'd reinvented into different fields. And one of those fields was within the world of HR, which I hadn't considered, and also specifically in the world of training and development, which would get me on platform, as we say in this world, but in front of adults and adult learners and as a facilitator. And I just didn't know this existed, but boy, I just took to it for so many obvious reasons. I loved the field. I found and find leadership fascinating. I find systems and organizational change fascinating and the role of the individual in that. And just the modern workplace, it became really interesting to me and something I could sink my teeth into that also felt sort of adequately purpose-driven and humanistic, that I could also care about it. You know, that it's not just a technical discipline, but it was something I could really shape. And so I was a facilitator trainer for a while as an independent. And then I had HR jobs as a director of training in, you know, industries as diverse as insurance all the way to fashion. That's a whole other other time of life. But I decided I don't think being an employee is for me. And so I got laid off in a restructure from fashion. And I said, you know, I think I just want to be in the classroom. I want to be doing the work. I don't want to be managing the work, which is ironic because today as a CEO and founder of quite a large team, I am managing the work. But at the time I thought, I just want to be making that difference right at the point of the aha moment, that point of learning and seeing the lights go on for somebody is just so transformative and fills my cup every single time and it never gets old. Yeah, so I sort of went the route of the independent trainer. I delivered hundreds of sessions on so many different topics in the leadership catalog, from presentation skills to business writing to negotiation skills. I love, you know, you teach what you most need to learn. I was constantly truly being a facilitator, which I think means there you can't possibly also be a domain expert in all the things that you facilitate when you're a professional facilitator. But what it did do is get me up on platform, improvising, staying a step ahead of the learners, but you don't need to be 10 steps ahead, you just need to be one step ahead. And really the craft of leading a group from A to B would be something that would really hold me in good stead for the work I do today. So I was in, when I set up my company then 14 years ago or so, it was leadership and communication skills because that was what I knew. But I'm also LGBTQ and I've been out since I was 22, but I was closeted as a performer for sure. I mean, not to my friends, but certainly in the field. And then closeted in corporate roles until I ended up in fashion, which I thought I would love, but I kind of ended up hating for very different reasons. and then as an entrepreneur who would one day become woman-owned certified and LGBT-owned and certified and very proud to be those things. But, you know, I still walk into rooms where I'm the only woman in terms of what I can visibly see about people's gender identity. I'm certainly probably the only LGBTQ person and still, you know, feeling the fear of psychological safety and stigma and being stereotyped and limited in terms of people's conception of what I'm capable of and how much authority I have. So it's still just something that is so deep in me, the sort of fight for workplace advocacy and parity for LGBTQ people has been sort of a deep hobby / profession of mine. But then I was able to, over the years, realize that I could pivot Jennifer Brown Consulting to be dedicated to diversity, equity, and inclusion. But coming from that LGBTQ space of my own intersectionality as a woman in a male-dominated business world and also an LGBTQ person, I could bring those things, sort of my identity as part of my skill set, you know, and that's so true for so many of us. But then kind of layering on the technical skill set of diversity, equity, inclusion. And I pivoted the firm, I'd say, probably 10 years ago. And we started to really go hard towards that direction. Yeah. And it's really, I have never felt so needed and wanted as we do now as a field. It's a long time coming. And it's been frustrating to argue why this is important for so long and have that kind of fall on deaf ears, except for a couple really progressive early adopter leaders and companies and clients. But we've been hanging in there. And there are people that predate me way back, you know, that have been writing about this and consulting on it. So I stand on those shoulders. But it's just really incredible to feel validated and feel that this is central now to the conversation in a way that it always deserved to be.
It definitely inspires, we find inspiration in ourselves from our own personal experience, right? How do you see, you know, we talk about this idea of bringing your whole self to work. And I'm sure you work with many organizations today that are really focused on that and say that we want to do this, but are just struggling to start or to know where to start. How do you suggest people from an employee perspective, but also from an organization perspective, where do people start with just creating an environment to allow this?
Well, there's the individual lens and then the organizational lens.
Let's start with the individual, because I think you bring up a good point. You said, never forget the voice that you're granted or never lose sight of the voice that you have. I've heard you say something along those lines. So I loved that, by the way, and that's very inspirational. And I think maybe we could start with the individual side.
Yeah. And you know, the quote you just said, I don't even remember saying that, by the way. Now I'm like thinking about that because the voice we're granted is either coming from a marginalized place. The voice we're granted is to be a change agent, show up fully, you know, change hearts and minds with our own stories, right? With our truth. And the voice we're granted for those of us that are overrepresented in the workplace and perhaps more comfortable because the workplace was built by and for people that look like us, the voice we're granted is that access and comfort and permission to rattle the cage. That's the voice. So depending on, I think this all comes back to like, what identity are we looking at this question through? That is a prism, right? That gives it kind of double meaning. So everything I talk about always has this double meaning I always think about. And that meaning is spread across, I would say, sort of privileged and marginalized identities and everything in between. Because by the way, we all have a combination. Most of us have a combination of those things. Many of us have invisible aspects of diversity that we really haven't grappled with or thought about as diversity dimensions. I taught a program once for veterans in a large financial institution, and they were they identify as veterans, but they're in this corporate role now. And it was, the feedback on diversity was, well, we've never thought about ourselves as a diverse group or a group that doesn't have a voice or struggles with stigma and stereotypes. But meanwhile, we sort of dug into that, and they realized, you know, the retention numbers are horrible for veterans in the corporate space. I mean, they literally last 2 years. There is a ton of microaggressions and stereotypes applied to them that are harmful, and biases that occur that thwart their performance and also thwart their sense of self and confidence in terms of navigating those spaces. So anyway, I love the opportunity to expand our aperture and be more inclusive of all diversity dimensions, particularly invisible ones, and particularly ones that broaden our thinking beyond race and gender. I think it's really, really important. And if I were to walk on stage, I mean, you can see me now, but our listeners can't, but I can walk on stage and pass as straight and never bring it up. And yet, you know, I really challenge myself to, what we talk about with the iceberg, lower my waterline and be comfortable being uncomfortable. And the uncomfortable is coming out over and over on stages everywhere with hundreds or thousands of people in the room, you know, pre-pandemic or on Zoom, and, you know, kind of facing that fear every single time. And, you know, depending on who's in the audience, the fear is ratcheted up. You know, if I'm feeling sort of, I'm looking around and I'm making my own assumptions about who is listening to me and, you know, how they can sort of diminish me and imagining that that's going to happen. Whether that happens or not is a different question. But it is the perception. Perception is reality. And when we walk through the world in our identities and we're used to being put into boxes and, you know, having all these presumptions made about us, you know, it ends up kind of living in us. And anyway, so when we do individual work, I just covered a couple things that I would say are important, like lowering the waterline, grappling with all of who we are, particularly the invisible aspects of our diversity, joined with the visible aspects, right, that cause those reactions in others and those biases in others. And then in my second book, How to Be an Inclusive Leader, I centered it around a model, a maturity model, or sort of a progression model. It's a continuum of change, and it goes from unaware to aware to active to advocate. And I think one of the unlocks these days, especially after 2020, has been, where am I? Where am I starting from? And if I am unaware, am I kind of asleep to the problem, or do I not have a fire for change, or am I not understanding my role in change? It's so important for me as a consultant. I want to meet the learner where they're at. And I think as we wake up, we were woken up and shaken by 2020 in so many ways. We were shown so much truth, so much pain, whether that pain was ours or someone else's. We were given a lesson in inequities, from, you know, healthcare disparities with COVID to socioeconomic differences with our colleagues and our coworkers, and peering into each other's living rooms and our lives and seeing how difficult it is relatively for some of us and not for others to flourish and thrive in this work from home world with homeschooling, et cetera. So anyway, I think that the empathy quotient, I hope, for so many of us was really pumped up last year. And that's something that we have to hold on to. And then we need to get on this journey of learning as individuals, because we can't outsource diverse and inclusive organizations of belonging. We can't outsource it to people who've been the most marginalized and been the least heard historically. And I think we'll look back on these times and say, wow, we really left a lot of the heavy lifting of this organizational transformation to people that had the least, I think the least power from a traditional definition of power to shift it. And then we left everybody else on the sidelines to sort of go about their quote unquote business, right? And that we permitted this looking at DEI as optional. And we didn't jump in holistically. And particularly people with power and influence didn't really take it on as their own. And so when I wrote How to Be an Inclusive Leader, that was my goal to say, this is yours. And not just yours as a chore, but yours as an opportunity to transform as a leader and actually become more empathetic and more resonant with the people that you're leading, with the colleagues that you partner with the customers that you're building products and services for. Because chances are, if you're a white, straight guy, cisgender guy, your team is not going to look like you and the customers aren't going to look like you anymore. And that is not changing. The demographic train has left the station and some of us will become the quote unquote minority in terms of our colleagues, in terms of our workforce. We already are in some cases, in terms of our customers, in terms of those who have the most buying power. So 2020, I think, hastened that realization that I was trying to create for so long to say, this is an opportunity to really shift our understanding of our own leadership, really take on the discomfort, the uncomfortable, the unfamiliar, really learn how to lead and partner across difference, you know, really think about all that we don't know and really like take our lens off and then put other lenses on of identity and grapple with that. And what does that beautiful potential of diversity plus inclusion and what can it create in terms of innovation and belonging and connectedness and trust? And then, by the way, we have to do all this virtually now, and that looks like it's here to stay. So, yeah, so that's a whole other, other fun challenge for transformation.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned the book, How to Be an Inclusive Leader. And I would think as an author, I have not authored anything yet. Maybe at some point I'll write a book. Maybe.
You must.
At some point. I'm very inspired by authors. And I would think a part of the personal reward of being an author is hearing some success stories of or the impact that your book or what you have authored has had on an individual or an organization. Could you share a story of a moment of success that you have heard from the book?
Yeah, my publisher and editor gave me wonderful advice when we were writing it. He said, this is a pass-along book. So you know your advocates well, you know the choir, right? We have a lot of conversations in the choir. But to reach that next rung out in the bullseye, which is this big, giant group of people that may not know about me, may not know about the topic, how can we write something that somebody in my inner circle who gets it and has been working on this can actually give to somebody to say, here, I have something for you to read that will help. And that has happened. It has actually happened. It's been manifested exactly like he predicted. And I'm so grateful that he framed it in that way, because then that focused my writing to say, how can I reach that next rung out? Because I don't need to reach the choir. Like, we're the ones doing the work and carrying the water and, you know, putting ourselves on the line every single day. And I want to give those people the tools to enlist others, to involve others, to equip others that feel completely at sea. And so my understanding, and it's an intuitive understanding, but it also comes from years of consulting, I can just feel how confused people are. I just feel it, you know, because those are my people to a certain degree. I mean, I just happened into this work because I had to, because I came out and I had to grapple with the being an outsider all of a sudden as a girl and a young woman of privilege, of many, many privileges. I was all of a sudden thrust when I came out into this other conversation and this other identity and community that I would come to embrace and love and cherish and fight for. I was largely a person that had grown up in a bubble. And so it's been my own journey also. And so I want to go back and get people, you know, I want to go back and say, like, hey, this can be your journey too. And by the way, like, it can like deeply enrich your life, like deeply, like personal life, family, community, workplace, leadership, all of it. Like, it's just, once you sort of switch that aperture, I talk about this whole world opens up to you of richness and learning and difference and cultural identity and just experiences. And to me, it's like the challenge of a lifetime to try to grapple with the limitations of how we look at the world. And then when we take those blinders off, what is available to us. So the aha moments, I think, are the ability to put a very easy to read, short, concrete book in somebody's hands that feels extremely overwhelmed by 2020. So much to learn, so much guilt, and in some cases, shame, so much regret, I think, around what was I was not taught, what I didn't understand, what I never questioned, what I was silent on. I mean, there's just this massive awakening, and it is such a gift. And I'm so dedicated to not squandering a single piece of what happened last year. That is so paramount to me, to say that we were given gifts of so much honesty, so much trust, so much bravery, so much courage in terms of people sharing their lived experience. We must always remember that. We must lead with that. We must, you know, rebuild organizational strategies and processes around what we learned and what we heard. Got to take that on board. And those of us who can run the furthest with something, those of us who can, with one signature, at one approval, change an entire, you know, experience or policy that impacts so many in our workplaces today and tomorrow, it is incumbent on us to do that. And we have to be hungry for those opportunities to use our voice. So I think more than any other book I've released, I think most of the books in the reading that everybody was told to read last year, right, Patrick? It was like,
yes,
like a big old thunk. Here's everything you didn't learn for the last 400 years of history. And by the way, history is written by the victors. You were not, you were not challenged to understand this. You were kept comfortable. You were not, you just weren't, I don't know. I mean, I regretted in my own schooling. I just can't believe that how much I was not taught. I'm like so angry about it. I'm just really angry. The way I grew up, the lack of exposure. I mean, I had wonderful and beautiful exposure to things that my parents knew, which is not about this at all. And I grew up in a lily white world, an extremely privileged world socioeconomically. In extreme safety, even as an LGBTQ person, the safety that my skin color afforded me, the safety that my socioeconomic background afforded me, protected me. And as soon as I put those dots together and I realized the diversity within the diversity, right? The diversity of voices in LGBTQ identity that are not heard, that are subject to violence and suicide and homelessness and transphobia, and what occurs with my gender non-binary friends and loved ones. Like, it just, you talk about the burden of that to say, where have I just not been inclusive, even as somebody with multiple marginalized identities? Same goes for being, you know, female and woman and sort of oriented around like female voices. Have we truly been inclusive of all female voices in all the definitions of that? You know, again, like even within my identity, and I want people listening to this to realize like we have work to do within our communities in addition to across our communities of identity. There is so much deep intersectional work that needs to happen where we need to pay attention to and orient our strategies around those identities, because then all of the rest of us benefit. But traditionally, we've really only oriented our strategies to benefit the most privileged amongst each of these identities. And so anyway, I don't know if you want to go into that, but it's really important from a people perspective. And those of you who are people officers and HR leaders, you might see this occurring in your diversity efforts. You might see the Women's Network, you might see the Black Network, you might see the LGBTQ network that's led entirely by white cisgender gay men, for example. You might see your Women's Network doesn't have a lot of ethnic diversity in it, doesn't have disabilities diversity, doesn't have LGBTQ diversity in it, you know. So these are not anyone's fault. It's more that we are destined to repeat unexamined systems, even as we try to build remedies to address them.
That's a great point. And something that you've done quite a bit of work on, this concept of diversity councils. And I think that's a really good, just a quick thing for us to, well, we could talk a whole episode about diversity councils, but a lot of our listeners today are building diversity councils for their first time. And again, I think that is such a great step forward for so many organizations. But there are lessons to be learned about doing it not the right way, or yeah. When I say the right way, the most effective way. So if you just told a little bit around what to think about or what potentially could not be correct about a diversity council. If you had maybe like one or two, three, if you could, but I mean, what are some things to really think about when you're saying, okay, I'm going to build a diversity council. What do I need to really think about when I'm building this from the ground up?
Yeah. And thank you for asking that. I think it is everybody's first time in many cases. So when we say council, I want to define terms really quickly. Typically, a diversity council is made up of most senior functional leaders. And sometimes the CEO, him or herself, sits on that council. And often it's senior leaders, functional leaders, so that there's representation across a business. And that council, given the seniority in that group, is responsible for the air cover, right? The sponsorship, the championing, the kind of muscle, if you will, right? That comes with seniority and the oversight of an effort. And sometimes that council is the group that's our working group at JBC. We build the diversity strategy with that council because it's important to engage your business leaders when you build your strategy for obvious reasons. But that's not the only, because sometimes that group is not very diverse for obvious reasons, right? We see the least diversity at the top of the organizational structure. So when you build a diversity council, you may not have a lot of lived experience diversity available to you to compose that group. And so that's not the only reason, but then there's the affinity group structure, which is different and tends to be not the most senior individuals, but the, I would say, mid-level and emerging talent level and populated with all the lovely and amazing diversity in those parts of the organization, right? Where the most diversity lives. And there can be up to 12 to 15 different affinity groups in organizations I work with. We set those up and we set councils up, right? So that I just want to differentiate. I think the biggest difference of those is seniority and also lived experience diversity, right? Because of the demographics of organizations. So that's one thing. I think my advice is to think about this as a bottoms up and top down and the frozen middle approach. And this is my org design brain, right? Which goes to who has the influence and the knowledge to do what, and how do we put each sort of stakeholder group in the right place, you know, and to doing the right things that are appropriate for them to be doing. And for the affinity groups, which are often called employee resource groups, often called business resource groups, BRGs, they go by a lot of different names, but they need to be strategically aligned to the business goals, solving real problems, real challenges with that beautiful diversity of identity and thought that exists in those groups, enhancing talent value propositions, recruitment, retention, helping the company understand, you know, what gets in the way for our demographic. So for LGBTQ groups, half of us are closeted in the workplace. So this conversation and the education that needs to go around this is so important, because if we're closeted in the workplace, we're not bringing our full selves to work and we're more likely to quit. We're more likely to hop to another company where we feel valued and we can bring our full self and not anticipate the stigma and the stereotypes, right? So we're always kind of evaluating our employer based on, can I feel comfortable and safe here to do my best work? And that's a big question for us in the community. So the ERG elevates these concerns to decision makers who need to learn about the diversity that lives in these affinity groups. And then this diversity council of leaders needs to take this on and, you know, do this kind of data collection and the development of the strategy and then the ownership and the accountability for the strategy. That's what senior people need to do. It's inappropriate to give anyone who's more junior or mid-career responsibility for driving a strategy. In the RACI model, which all of you know, RACI, responsible, accountable, consulted, and informed, we need to have an appropriate level of assignment and role or hat that we wear vis-a-vis these efforts. But it takes all of us. It takes that top down, bottom up. Ideally, every strategy has the business alignment, which we very much encourage and kind of bake into everything we're involved in, which is, you know, what is the company going to look like 5 years from now, 10 years from now? How will we make sure our workforce mirrors the diversity of the world that we're doing business in? where are we losing people of certain demographics? Do we track that information? We need to start with data, both quantitative and qualitative. So we always start with a data collection process through focus groups, surveys, one-on-one interviews. We roll it up. We give it to the diversity council usually. And we say, like, here's the state of the state. Here's your current state. What does good look like? We don't say, what does success look like? Because honestly, the bar is constantly moving with this work. And really, I know everybody loves to obsess about when are we going to be done and be able to check the box. And this work is ongoing. It's a journey. You got to just hunker down and just live it every day. And knowing that the goalpost is going to continue to change. And by the way, that's not a bad thing because the world is changing quickly. Your talent is changing quickly. We need to constantly be evolving and iterating on the strategy in order to respond to, for example, social justice issues or, you know, issues in the world that companies more and more are kind of stepping into and commenting on and leading on or taking a stand on. You know, this is evolving. And it will continue to evolve. And I think that's not a bad thing. I think we've got to have more agile organizations. We've got to have leaders that are have their finger on the pulse all the time, that are ready to respond and aren't panicked and go dark or silent or say the wrong thing. I mean, we've got to become extremely attuned to our workforce, the needs, the wants, the challenges, the barriers that they're experiencing, and really attuned to how our world outside is shifting and how to really resonate with all that and get comfortable being uncomfortable. And to me, that means not knowing the answer, because I might say there really is not an answer. This is admitting to imperfection you brought up, Patrick, sort of not making perfect the enemy of the good, not being obsessed with, if I can't do this perfectly, I'm not going to do it at all. Or if I can't do it perfectly, I'm not going to talk about it until it's perfect. Leaders need to show up imperfectly. That is the whole, and companies need to say, we know we have work to do. Here's the work as we've defined it and educated ourselves about it. Here's what our goals are. Here's what you're going to see us doing imperfectly. Here's what we want feedback on as we go. And, you know, this, we need input. We need the knowledge that lives in our organization so that we can get it better, not right. And, you know, just that openness and willingness to be confronted with what's being experienced by people, I mean, it's a huge step. I think companies swept so much under the rug historically. They didn't really want to know what we were there to show. I think there was a willful blindness, a denial, I'm a good person, I'm a good leader, this can't be true. I believe in diversity, so therefore, you know, my intent dictates that this is a great place to work for everybody. Mm-mm. No. Just because you feel it's comfortable and great and, you know, our ego gets involved and we say, oh, you know, of course that's not true in my organization. Of course, you know, women don't feel like that here. They can't possibly feel that way. Look at all the women we have or whatever. And then you dig into the pay gap, you dig into the data that you collect, and it's a shock. And I think it really pops the balloon. And I think that's such an important part of sort of organizational truth. We have to have a truthful conversation that's grounded in data. And then we need to go from there, no matter how it reflects on us and what we believe ourselves to be.
Yeah. There's a structure, I think, that is put around, to your point, you were talking about affinity groups and diversity councils and ERG. And I think that foundation is very much organizations should have that, but how that looks in a business, what those groups are, what they're made up of, that all is dependent on the people in a business, right? Like, it's just, everything's a bit different. So it's okay to figure it out, I guess is what I'm saying.
I think that's true. Yeah, I would sort of agree with you. I would say there are, like, it's sort of build it and they will come. Like, there are structures you just need to have in place.
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
So in a way there is, like, affinity groups are, when I meet a CEO and they're like, well, we don't want affinity groups because they're divisive and we're scared of that. Respectfully, I will say, I'm not sure how you're going to operate in this day and age without, you may be too small to have them. I get that. But maybe then you have, you know, smaller, more sort of multicultural, multi-identity networks, or maybe you have a diversity council instead that is sort of a precursor to affinity groups. But there needs to be feedback mechanisms like this. There need to be safe spaces to support your employees who are feeling unsafe on a day-to-day basis, both outside the workplace and then coming into work with microaggressions and bias. There needs to be a safe space, I think, for people to just like reconcile their experience with each other in an honest place, and then to figure out, like, not to complain, but to figure out, so what is our approach going to be to making our workplace better, to enhancing it for people that identify like we do? It's a huge kind of release valve for employees. And I think, you know, just to have that as an option and to have them be formally recognized and mandated and sanctioned and supported and championed, is it sends an enormous signal. I mean, there's just so many good things about them. So with that CEO that says, I think they're divisive, he's sort of seeing it in this like one very narrow way and kind of missing the bigger opportunity. So, you know, we try to be respectful of where they are, but of course, you know, the client is always right. However, not always.
Pushing people into their uncomfortable zones is quite important, as you talked about earlier.
It is important. I did for a sports company that shall not be named. I remember I did all their focus groups, and then they were creating ERGs for the first time. And they said, we just don't think we're ready for the LGBTQ group. Oh, it was not even Q at that time. It was just LGBT. And I said, respectfully, if you were to create these groups right now and leave that group out, I think the optics of that is really hurtful and harmful and will be misinterpreted. And honestly, you have LGBT people in your organization, newsflash, and lots of allies that would really like to be activated and have something to participate in. And lo and behold, you know, they took our advice, but there was a lot of push and pull and a lot of dialogue around, we're afraid to take this step. So, you know, that is a really important lesson. Same as like male ally groups. I mean, some of my clients are starting men as allies networks, and there's tons of pushback on that from all sides, actually. Like, why do men need a space? You know, the world is their oyster, right? And just all of those kind of, I guess, I don't know, people, I'm not sure if they think they're being funny, or it's, to me, it feels very dismissive of the work that really needs to happen for all of us. We all have to have a place to say, hey, I don't know the answer. I need to learn. And before I go out there and declare my allyship, let's have a space where I can learn what that actually means so that I don't go out and cause unintentional harm just being who I am and as clueless as I am, you know. And I can say that because I'm that clueless person. But I would argue a lot of us are clueless. You know, yeah, there's cluelessness. There's enough cluelessness to go around in all identities about other identities. So anyway, I think, and then I would say too, to have a strategy. Every organization needs a DEI strategy. Like, treat it like every other business objective. You know, really nail it down to workforce, workplace, marketplace, whichever pillars you really want to orient it around. But create, with the help of an external consultant like us or on your own, but make sure you have a strategy and you're working the strategy every day so that you're not kind of doing these one-off, like, you could create employee resource groups, but I would say they need to dock in to a strategy that's owned by senior leadership, communicated out, and that there's an accountability and sort of a consistent messaging, and there's actions being taken by leadership along the way, so that it's not just, we can fall prey a bit to the thousand flowers blooming approach to, we'll do a little training and we'll have the ERGs and we'll do this. But without the connection, the docking into a sort of macro strategy that addresses business objectives, I think there can be a lot of wheel spinning going on and a lot of sort of dismissal as irrelevant. Oh, unconscious bias training. Well, I don't really know what it matters. Like, I'm not really sure why we're doing it. You know, I phone it in, I attend, and then I go back to my job. To me, that speaks to a lack of alignment to something that is truly supported in a proactive way by leadership, where everybody says, oh, I understand why we're learning about bias, because now we understand that it is prevalent in all of our systems and processes in every workplace. And we understand the harm that that causes. We understand the performance impact and the ROI and the bottom line impact of that. And this is one of many tactics that we're adopting to tackle it. And if I could hear that amongst coming out of unconscious bias training, I'd be so happy. This is why we deliver inclusive leadership training. I think that's our preference over unconscious bias training, honestly, because we prefer to have a behavior-based conversation and a skill-building conversation. Yes, the science of bias is really important to understand, but that's not, when I go back to my job, how can I put this in practice from a tactical, concrete perspective every single day in my hiring, in my interview processes, in my resume reviews, in my promotion and advancement, in my performance reviews, really getting down to brass tacks from a people processes perspective. And that would change behavior, and then holding people accountable then to creating making the behavior change, being measured. If you want to really bring this full circle, then the performance reviews measure our ability to not only attract diverse talent over time, but retain that talent and also get amazing numbers in terms of our engagement scores cut by diverse dimensions so that we understand like how a leader is doing, not just based on who they can bring in, but who they keep, who they promote in advance, and who reports feeling fully able to thrive and a high sense of belonging. That would be how I would hold leaders accountable. And sadly or not sadly, sometimes what gets measured gets done. I mean, we can wait forever for people's better angels to say, I want to be a better person, a better human. I'm going to do this because of all the things Jennifer says, you know, that I'm going to benefit from. But, you know, it's the carrot and the stick, you know, and I think both of those probably need to be utilized so that we can create sustainable and broader change versus just leaving it up to people kind of when they feel like it. The when they feel like it is not going to get the job done. And I fear we're going to continue to lose really amazing talent if we kind of leave this to somebody's better angels. It's just the moral argument for all this stuff, like all of us in the field sort of wish that could be enough. I wish it could be enough for me to say, I'm closeted at work and I'm making up a lie about who I love and what I did over the weekend because I'm so terrified to tell you who I am. I wish that were enough. However, some people don't think it's enough. So I can't fathom it, but it's all right. You know what? We meet people where they're at, and there's like, I try to just not have judgment because it's sort of a road that goes nowhere. Because ultimately, I think we have to keep our eye on the prize and enlist as many people, meet as many people where they're at with whatever compelling information will create that aha moment. I don't kind of care which one it is as long as people get on the train.
Jennifer, this has been an amazing conversation. We are coming to the end, but just to wrap it up quickly, I just want to say, first off, thank you for telling your story, for inspiring me, for inspiring our listeners, for doing the work that you do. Please continue to have the passion that you've had over the past 45 minutes of time speaking, and just a heartfelt thank you for what you're doing and for your perspective and for giving us all inspiration for what is possible, because that is really how we can be fueled for the future, is just to keep our eyes on what is possible. So thank you, Jennifer. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much. I feel so seen, Patrick. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was excellent. Thank you so much.
And that was Be More, a podcast by Peakon. Be sure to search for Be More in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, or anywhere else that you get your podcasts from. And go ahead and subscribe so that you don't miss out on any future conversations. On behalf of the team here at Peakon, thanks for listening.